Let's begin. I think the technical difficulties have been solved. So what I want to do today is pick up where I left the theoretical lecture last week. I want to show you how to solve a partial differential equation using finite differences. That's the method that I introduced last week. The homework question that I posed is to solve a partial differential equation using a spectral method. I thought about which one should I pose as a homework problem. And I think for finite differences, there are lots of tricks and small technicalities that people are using. So I'm going to introduce these today, and I'm going to pose the, let's say, easier thing as a homework. It's not easier in a mathematical sense, it's easier in a software engineering sense. So let's get started with the problem that we want to solve. We want to solve an easy equation is the scalar wave equation. We want to solve it in two dimensions. So let's choose a domain that goes from minus 1 to plus 1 in both directions. And the equation that we want to solve is dt squared phi equals dx squared phi plus dy squared phi. These are the complicated terms. In real life, there'd be additional terms here, lower order terms. The wave speed could be different in different places and so on. But these are rather straightforward to add and don't add to the main complications, so I'm going to leave them out today. Also, whenever there's a partial differential equation, one needs to give boundary conditions. So the simplest kind of boundary condition is that phi at the boundary, the omega, we set it to 0. That domain here, let's call it omega. Setting the boundary for phi to 0, that's like when you have a string on a guitar or on a violin, and you clamp it down, so anything that hits the boundary will be reflected there. That's the simplest kind of boundary condition. You can write PhD theses on boundary conditions. Let's not do that. The other boundary condition, where things are not reflected but go through, or you can make the boundary time dependent, where you start to wiggle the boundary at the point and then shoot waves into the domain. Not going to do that. And the physical system that we want to investigate later on, we start with some kind of wave peak somewhere. So this system actually behaves like the surface of a pond where you wiggle something. So you're going to start something approximately here, and then you're going to shoot it off in some direction, and it's going to hit the boundary and bounce off and bounce around, and then you'll see various effects. And that being 2D and time dependent, it also will allow you to make a movie out of it, if you so want. So the initial condition will be something here that moves in this direction. Having discussed the system, we're going to discretize it in space using finite differences. Going to go through that again. So there are going to be a set of points here, which is kind of the centers of the basis functions. We know the solution there. And to solve it in time, this is a hyperbolic partial differential equation, we are going to use the time integrators that I introduced when we spoke about ODE integration about a week or so ago. The idea is that this function phi is a continuous function. It depends on t, x, and y. We're going to express it in terms of these basis functions, evaluating it at these points. Then the result are the coefficients that still depend on time. And that is then a coupled system of ODEs. And that is then going to be integrated in time using a standard method, because we don't want to make it too complicated. The standard methods, the simplest standard methods, they expect that the solution is first order in time. That means they expect that there's only one time derivative, not two time derivatives. So we're going to have to rewrite the system into a system that is first order in time. Tell me how to do that. Okay, the way to do that is to introduce a new variable. Let's call it phi. And we define phi to be the time derivative, psi. Time derivative for phi, Greek letters, confusing here. And after this definition, we have a system where we specify the time derivatives of both phi and psi. how is the time derivative of phi given? I'm not getting much feedback here, but it's just this equation. So it's given by psi, and the time derivative of psi, if you plug in this, is the second time derivative of phi. So we can just read it off here. That's dx squared phi plus dy squared phi. So this is the system that we're going to solve in the end. Now we have twice as many variables. We have phi and psi. That's the price we pay. So we're going to expand both phi and psi in terms of finite differences here. If you were to do this in real life, not in a simple problem, it would make sense to look for a different time integrator that can handle systems that have second time derivatives. That would be way more elegant, probably had a lot of advantages for solving the system. But here I want to introduce not a very specific method for this equation, but rather something in general. And most people, when solving a PDE in this way, are going to use systems that are first order in time. Okay, I'm thinking whether I need to introduce anything else or whether we can move to the practical example. And as usual, you don't need to write this down. You're going to get that notebook later on. It's probably better if you pay attention and help me debug the code. So I'm trying to do some live coding here. And we're going to continue with this example. Or you might want to continue with this example this afternoon in the tutorial. So, what do we need? Let's start by setting up some initial conditions. Let's start up by defining this grid here. We need to have a certain number of points. So let's just use a variable for that. Let's call it endpoints. And let's just start with something really small, ridiculously small. Let's just use 5 points. And we won't be able to solve it with 5 points, but it's just easier to debug if we choose a small number like that. Later on, when we solve it, we're probably going to use 101 points or something similar. Then the visualization looks better. And then there's a grid spacing that is usually called H. And H is given by 2 over endpoints minus 1. Why 2 over and not 1 over? The size of the domain goes from minus 1 to plus 1. So the domain size is 2. And why divided by endpoints minus 1? H is the spacing between the grid points. Why not divide by the number of points or number of points plus 1? If we have 5 points here, then there are 4 spacings between these points. So these things, like plus 1 and minus 1, these are the pesky details that is difficult to get right. And can easily confuse yourself. So we have this one here. And now let's set up some initial conditions. Here, I'm using for the solution 2 variables, phi and psi. It's customary, it's convenient to put the whole state vector into a single variable. So I'm going to call the single variable big U. Oh, great, there still is a star here. I don't like that. What is happening here? I hope this is working. Sorry. I hope this is working. Well, I'm getting stars. That is good. Okay. I'm initializing the bit state vector. This big state vector is going to be a large array that holds all the points in the x, all the points in the y directions, and endpoints, 2. The last 2 is for the 2 variables. If I set the last index to 1, that's the 2D array for phi. If I set it to 2, that's the 2D array for psi. and I'm setting it to 0. And yeah, just showing that, looks like that now, very boring. Let's, if you write a notebook, then it's tempting to just write the for loops and everything yourself. It's good style to put things into functions as much as possible. So let's do that. Let's write a function. Let's just call it init. And this function returns the initial conditions. So here we have a u, and later we're going to return u. And now we need to set up something interesting. So we're going to loop over all these points and set up some interesting initial condition here. Let's do that. There's a particular pattern for that. For j in 1 to n points, I in 1 to n points. So you need a two-dimensional loop, a nested loop. And it's more efficient if you loop ji instead of ij. That's just how things work. It comes from Fortran. Depends on how this memory is laid out in memory. And let's calculate the coordinates of that point. The x coordinate is minus 1 plus I minus 1 times h. Do you see why this is the case? If I is 1, then this is the first point. If I is 1, then in the first expression, the product vanishes. So we added minus 1. That is correct. And the grid spacing is h. So whenever I increases by 1, we want to move to the right by h. So the first expression is correct because we validated it in two cases. And it's linear in I, so it must be correct. And similar with y. So coming up with this expression is again a thing that you must have seen before. And if you haven't seen it before, it's difficult to get this yourself and get it correct. Now we have x and y. And now let's calculate the value for phi. What should we do for phi? Just some Gaussian, right? Exponential minus. What should we do here? More parentheses x minus x naught squared plus y minus y naught squared divided by 2w or something. Why not? We need to define these things. X naught equals 0, y naught equals minus 0.5, 0.1 or something. Let's make it a bit wider. And we set psi to 0, and then u equals phi, and uij2 equals psi. Okay. Do you all understand this code? I'm not getting much feedback from you, so I just assume it's fine. I'll be happy to discuss it in detail, in particular the more technical parts of it, yi, yj, and so on and so forth. So let's do that. We have this initialization function. What else do we need to have? In the end, we want to call the time integrator. And for this time integrator, we need to have a right-hand side function. So maybe we should implement that next. Sorry, yes, you're saying?
We should have a matrix who takes the derivative of the variable.
Yes.
We should also consider the boundary conditions for guessing the first.
I forgot the boundary conditions. Yes. So these initial conditions, actually, they don't apply the boundary conditions. That is wrong. So maybe we should fix that. Okay, let's add an if statement. If I equals 1 or I equals n points. Or j equals 1? Yeah, boundaries are messy. Then we set it to 0. Else. And then let's indent here. Oh, so tedious. Okay. If we're on any boundary point, then we set the initial conditions to zero. I said we're setting phi to zero. Psi being the time derivative, then is automatically all set to zero. So that follows from that. Okay. These are the initial conditions, and I'm kind of pushed the boundary conditions in there. That's not really elegant, but it will do. Now let's write a right-hand side function. And the right-hand side will act on a U, on such a state vector, and then produce something that is called U dot or something. There's this function similar, which takes an array and produces a new array with the same characteristics, but it's not initialized. And here we are going to have a loop as well. Let me just copy that loop here. Sorry, I'm copying everything, but of course the content will be different. So going to delete all the bits. Actually, the boundary treatment here is correct already, because if you're on a boundary, then the right-hand side there is also zero, if the first and second time derivatives. And elsewhere, we need to calculate the second derivative. Do you remember the finite differencing stencil? Oh, I'm sorry. When I explained how to use spectral methods, I showed how to create a matrix that contains the derivative operator, the derivative matrix. You can do that as well for finite differences, but for finite differences, it's more customary to evaluate the matrix at that point instead of storing it in a matrix, because that is faster, then you never need to store the matrix there. Depending on what equation you solve, you might need the matrix, you might need to invert it or something, but here we don't. So let's calculate the second derivative of phi, let's call it phi xx. So remember, phi is stored in the first index here. And I don't know whether you recall the finite differencing stencil. Do you recall the finite differencing stencil for a second derivative? Let's just catch it on. Yeah, let's just move the blackboard up. So we have a function here, and we have 3 points here. Oh man, yeah, it's not a good function. Let's make it look like that. Actually, it's probably easier to imagine that the function looks like that. Then we have 3 points here. You want to evaluate the second derivative here, so we can look at the neighboring points. If this is point I, it's always good to label things. This is point I minus 1, and this is point I plus 1. And we're only looking at this x derivative, so it doesn't matter what happens in the y direction, it'll be the same thing. So if this is f, then f double prime at point I is then what? Probably remember that we have these finite differences, so we need to divide for something with a grid spacing. Pardon?
If the spacing is h, then
yes. Very good. And in the numerator, it was a linear combination of these 3 points. So let me just write it down, and then we can fill in the respective coefficients. So it depends on fi minus 1 and fi and fi plus 1.
Minus for the first one.
Do you want to have a minus here?
Sorry, so the second term.
Here, a minus?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then minus 2. Oh,
yes.
Minus 2 for that one.
Yes. It's minus 2 on the coefficients here, a plus 1. So this 1 over h squared is because of the second derivative. Good call. And the other thing is, if this is a constant function, the result must be 0. So the sum of all these coefficients must be 0. That's the case. If this is a linear function, and the second derivative must all be zero. So if you multiply this coefficient by minus one and this by zero and this by plus one, the result must also be zero. So these two must be the same. And if it is a parabola, then this must return two. So if you put x squared in there, the derivative of x squared is 2x. So if you put x squared in there, then you see that you actually get 2. So if you have x equals 0 here, x equals minus 1 and plus 1, then this coefficient times plus 1, this times 0, and this again times plus 1 must be 2. And indeed, the sum of these two coefficients is 2. And then this must be minus 2 from the first condition that they all sum up to 0. So you just put in the functions, constant function x and x squared, and they must have the correct value, and this is how you can deduce the coefficients. Or, of course, you go to Wikipedia. There's a page, list of finite differencing coefficients, and you just read it off there. So let's implement that. So this is what's happening? Oh, don't tell me that my laptop is freezing now. Oof. No, come on. Oh. Okay, how do I do that? Does it make it smaller? Make it larger. Hit reload. Oh no, reload was not good. Now I'm losing everything. I express my unhappiness about the performance of the technical support for this lecture. Okay, I'll unplug the cable and plug it back in, and I hope this works. No, it doesn't. Oh no, something happened. Very good. Plug it back in. This is ridiculous. So currently I'm using Safari. Let me switch to Chrome and open the same notebook. Oh, I hope it, let's hit the save button here. I hope that still works. And then we can continue. How do I go here?
Advanced.
Learn more, maybe? No.
It's advanced.
What is it?
Click on advanced.
Advanced, okay.
Proceed.
Thank you. Okay. That's not the... Oh, yeah, flickering. Very good, very good. I called this thing finite differences. Let's click on that. Double click, maybe. Good. And here we are. Okay, let's move that away. And make it a bit larger. Oof. Okay. I comma j comma 1 plus u of I plus 1 comma j comma 1 divided by a squared. Okay, this is a bit more complicated because we have u's and j's in there. So let's call it phi yy. And we calculate it in the same way. And just mentioning it, in real life, of course, there's nothing that prevents you from using different grid spacings in different directions. And having a domain that is not square, that works just well. And oh, we call this u dot, so we need to set u dot here. and we need to set u dot here. U dot for phi is given by psi, so this is uij2, and u dot for psi is given by just the sum of these two things, okay, phi xx plus phi yy. We have the boundary conditions, we have something for the initial conditions. I think we can call the time integrator now. Would that work? I think so. Yes, good. Let's set up initial conditions. U naught equals init, that is that. Then I don't know whether we recall how to call the time integrator. Let me just act as if I knew how to do that. We need to choose a time span, and then we have, is it ODE problem? Now we pass in the right-hand side function and the initial conditions and the time span. Okay, the right-hand side function. Oh yeah, the right-hand side functions needs to take as input not just the state vector, but also additional parameters. We don't use any parameters, but they expect it. So let's call it just P and the current time. Our PDE doesn't depend on the current time, but it could, right? For example, if the boundary could be time dependent, something special could be happening. So this is why I need to change the definition of the right-hand side function. Let's do that. Hey, that looks nice. And now let's solve it. And then we get a solution. And oh wow. It took 26 time steps to calculate the solution. That's good. If it takes one time step to calculate the solution, then you did something wrong. Maybe you set everything to zero. And if it takes a million time steps to calculate the solution, then something else went wrong. There's some instability or something. Okay. Wow, there's a lot of detail here. I don't want that much detail. Let me just use a semicolon here. And then length sol.t. This just is still too long. This just takes me how many time steps to check. And now let's plot it. Let's plot the initial condition that we have. Oh, I remember. We had a very coarse initial condition, right? The grid has just five points. So it's probably complete nonsense. That's probably why it was so fast. Okay, let's do that. Figure. You probably remember how to do that. And then what would you do? Heat map. I like heat map. And then we need to calculate all the positions, right? What are all the x-coordinates? Minus 1 plus... Oh no, we can do that. What's the grid spacing? H plus 1 minus 1, H plus 1. And then the solution at a particular time, at the initial time. And then just phi. And sorry, we have an axis. I think we do that. And then we plot the figure. Was that it? So when you call the heat map, you need to pause all the x coordinates, all the y coordinates, and the respective array. And then here, yeah, look at that. Oh. Yeah, when you plot something, the domain is a square. That thing is a rectangle. You need to look in the documentation to make sure that the aspect ratio is correct. I don't recall how to do that. That is probably a function that you can call x scale or y scale or something. But in your homework assignment, I expect you to do it nicely. Here, because I'm teaching on a blackboard, I have certain freedoms that you don't have in your reports. So that's the solution. And yeah, you see there's a big black border here. These are all the boundary points, where everything is zero. And then this 3x3 array is where we have a solution, and this is the Gaussian. There's not much to see of the Gaussian because the resolution is way too coarse. So let's increase the resolution a bit. I like to choose numbers of points that are a round number plus one, because then the grid spacing is a round number. And so let's do that. Run all cells. It's currently solving it. And here, when we're plotting, we're only plotting the initial conditions, not anything else. So this is the initial condition. Let's plot something else as well at a later time, for example, at time one. So the solution that is returned from the ODE integrator, I mean, you could look at the documentation for that, behaves like a function. And if you call it as a function and you pass a time, then it returns the solution at that time. And the solution is then, of course, the whole U state vector that we have. And then we just take phi, because we want phi. We are not plotting psi at the moment, at the later time. This is this. And that's not really useful, because we see there's something weird happening at the bottom, and the solution is large at the top, but we have no idea about what this means, how large the solution is, right? We need to add some kind of color bar also. Let's do that. So this is just about plotting. Color range. That's the scale. Yeah. Okay, sorry. I really hate that this is a rectangle. Let me try to fix it. What is it? Okay.
Just making the size of the figure equal.
Oh, yes, that should. Sorry. It's not making it really square. It's not nice, but of course it would help enough. Is this a square? No, maybe we'd play 440 or something. Yeah, that's better than nothing. Thanks for the pointer. This is not the right way to do it, but it looks much better already. Okay. We should also try to get some kind of movie going to see what happens. Okay. But okay. There's an effect I want to show. Let me try once more to see whether it's necessary, whether it's possible. Okay, let me try to put it into the same figure, because I want to show the solution at two times at the same time. Okay, maybe that's it. Okay, you don't really see anything. So you see two things. First, we put the Gaussian as the initial condition, but we cut off the Gaussian at the lower boundary because we set the boundary to zero, but the Gaussian is still far from zero. And this creates a large discontinuity, kind of like a shock wave. And this is what begins to propagate here from the bottom. This is a bad initial condition. I should actually fix it. Or maybe we should use initial conditions that are much smoother. Let me fix that, because this is not the effect I was going for. But this kind of experimenting with initial conditions when testing a code and so on, that is totally part of it. So let's make the Gaussian smaller, see whether that happens. And then we don't need this one anymore. Let's remove that. And let's run all cells. Yeah, still not better. Okay, but the thing that I wanted to say is that earlier I suggested we want to have a pulse that moves in a certain direction. And this is not the initial condition that we have. The initial condition that we set up is that we have the Gaussian blob at a certain point, and we set the time derivative to zero. And then what you're getting is not something that moves. you're getting something that essentially just starts to wave outwards. Okay, let me try to change the initial condition once more. And then I probably should have prepared to show a movie because that makes it easier to understand what is going on. But might as well turn this into an interactive lecture by you telling me how to make a movie. Do you know how to make a movie? Come on, one of you must know. Okay. Let's plot this at a later time. Maybe that makes it clear what's happening. No, it is too late. Is this clear? 0.4, 0.2, 0.3, maybe 0.4. Okay, maybe you see it. So we start with a Gaussian, and the system really behaves like surface waves of a water. So you have a pond, and there's kind of a blob on it, and what would happen if you let go? The blob would spread outwards, and you get kind of a ring-shaped wave, and the amplitude that decreases with 1 over r. And this is what we're seeing here. And this is why it's also difficult to see what's happened at the later time. This is the initial blob. It moves outwards in all directions. And yeah, that's not helpful. I mean, between that and the bad color scale I chose. And then, so you see that this is blue here. The amplitude there has gone to 0, and we have a ring-shaped wave moving outwards, decreasing like 1 over r. So the amplitude here is 1, and the amplitude here probably has gone down to, I don't know, 0.3 or something, and it's really difficult to see. Height lines, we can add height lines. So that also shows that just understanding how a solution looks like is not easy. You need to really look at it, you need to visualize it, and do other things. I think, is it heat map F, or what is it? Contour F? I think it's contour F. Yeah, there you go. This is much easier to understand, is it not? Okay, now of course you don't see that the amplitude here is much smaller, because apparently the contour lines are chosen automatically. So it looks as if the wave didn't decrease in amplitude, but you see that it moves outwards. And if I had prepared the magic incantations for actually plotting a movie, you would see that it moves outward and is reflected from the outer boundary and continues to move inwards. Okay. Should we try to make a movie, or should we look at other things, more mathematical topics? I think we can take the movie in the afternoon. And right now, we should look at the more mathematical topics. And one important topic is the topic of convergence. That is, if you have a Gaussian like this, and it's spherically symmetric, and it's far away from the outer boundary, then it's easy to find an analytic solution to that. You can ask Mathematica or find some lecture notes online where that happens. And then you have the analytic solution. And if you plot it like this, then you don't really see how far away you are from the analytic solution. But if you plot it, say, along the x direction, if you just take a cut at x equals 0 and see how the wave moves, then you would see that. And then you see that the numerical calculation has an error, that the wave doesn't move with quite the correct speed, and it doesn't quite have the correct amplitude. And so this 2D visualization is a good way to give you an overview. But in the end, we need to look into things into much more detail. So let's do that. This will be more mathematical and much less flashy. Let's use scatter. So we only looking along the x-axis. So this will, we will look at, what's the index here? Endpoints minus 1, that is an even number. And now we divide it by 2. this diff looks like a plus sign, but it's actually an integer division. And this, and now we add one again. Oof, that would be that. Let's plot it like this. And this should now be scat. So close, scatter. Okay, this is the initial condition that we choose. And now we already see much more about the solution. In particular, you see the weird kinks down here, because the Gaussian is not yet zero, and then we impose a boundary condition of zero, and that's not nice, right? These initial conditions are discontinuous. So I'm going to fix that by making the Gaussian a bit smaller and running it again. Almost there. And this looks nice. This is the initial condition. Does it look better if I write lines? Maybe. Or lines, points. What is it? Scatter lines? Do you know what it's called? Let's just call it lines. And let's add some more lines at different times. At time one and at time two. Sorry, time one half. And at time one. Wow, okay, that's not very useful. Let's remove that. Do we see something here?
It seems like the boundaries are not zero.
Oh, wow. Yes, we see two Y lines here. So I need to explicitly set the, what is it called, Y range? Do you remember?
They are zero.
Hope that's correct. Yes, seems to be working. No. Oh. Okay. I did not expect having this problem. Can one of you help me out by looking online for the documentation? I want to plot two curves into the same plot, but obviously I want to use the same Y range here. I'm surprised that this is happening. Apologies. Y limits, maybe? Looking myself. Sorry. Lines, line style, line width, color scale, color range, overdraw, model.
I think it might work if you remove the exclamation mark for the first one.
Okay.
And keep the second one.
Oh, you keep the second one.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I'll remove the limits. And that gives an error message. Generic attributes, model, space. It works here. It doesn't work for me. That is weird. Oh, I see. Haha. Okay. I'm creating a new axis every time. And I shouldn't be doing that. I need to plot into the same axis. What they call axis is essentially just the coordinate system. There you go. That is that. And now it also actually chooses different colors for the next thing. So at t equals 0, this is the Gaussian. And then at t equals 0.5, okay, let's add a few more here. 0.25, and then we see the solution. This is t equals 0, then t equals 1, it moves outwards and spreads out, and then it becomes negative. And then it moves further out, and here at that time it's already reflected by the outer boundary. So if you want to remove the effect from of the outer boundary, we need to make the Gaussian smaller still. And but what I wanted to show you that is much more important is the effect of the resolution. Right now I'm using 51 points. If I'm using more or fewer points, then there should be a difference in the solution. The crucial point is if you run a calculation with one resolution, you cannot trust the result because there will always be some numbers there and you don't know how wrong they are. So you run the solution, the calculation multiple times with different resolutions and you compare them, but not just in a nice colorful plot like here, but actually in a quantitative way. So let's make the Gaussian smaller still and see what happens then. Okay, sorry. Maybe now. I'm just tuning the numbers so that I can actually show the effect that yes, okay. So currently we run it with one resolution. Now I want to run the same thing with a different resolution and plot the solution into the same plot so that you see what the differences are. And to do that, I'm not going to fiddle with global constants. Rather, I'm changing the initial condition routine by, does that make sense? Yes. By making the, no, software engineering, no. By making the number of points an input of the routine for the initial conditions. And then I can, in the same notebook, calculate different initial conditions without having to change a global variable. So we change the number of points. That means we also have a different grid spacing here. And I remove this global variable here. And then I set initial conditions with 51 points. And then let's see what happens. Restart and run all cells. Plotting routine is going to complain because I'm using H here, and H is now not, the right-hand side routine, we also need to fix this. The number of points is this, we can find the number of points by looking at their array U, and then we can recalculate the grid spacing here. 2 over n points minus 1. So, sorry, we need to run it again. Let's just ignore this one here. And here, yeah, visualization, I don't care that much. Let's call it A0 equals 2 over 50. And let's call this H0 for the coarse solution. And then we should n points. Where is n points? Oh, okay. Call it end. That is a trick in Julia. If you write end somewhere within square brackets, it looks at the last index there, which is the same as the number of points. It's very convenient. So this is the solution. And let's just look at the solution at time. Yeah, let's make a copy of that because I want to compare different resolutions. Let's look at the solution at a particular time here. And let's rerun the same thing for different resolutions. So let's call this problem 0 and solution 0. Time span is this, oh man. Time span is the same. And then let's solve the problem as well. Let's call this U1. The numbering is not very good. where we use twice as many grid points. And with twice as many, of course, I mean 101. Why? You already know that. Because the grid spacing depends on the number of points minus one. If I choose it like this, then the grid spacing here is exactly twice the grid spacing here. So let's solve that. And then let's plot things for different resolutions. H1 is then 2 over 100. And then we should be able to, sorry, this was solution 0, this is solution 1. And now let's see what happens. This is not at all what I expected. What is wrong? Oh, here we're solving problem 1, and here we're solving problem 0. Okay, let's just restart the kernel, because I removed some variables to make sure I'm not accidentally using something that I defined earlier. Now, if I had been clever, then I would have written the notebook from the beginning without making the resolution the number of points a global variable. That is a bad idea. Now, I did that. That shaved off 2 minutes in the beginning of my presentation. But now I'm spending 10 minutes just fixing up all the inelegancies that I introduced. Okay. Now, solving the problem takes a bit longer. If I increase the resolution by a factor of 2, how much longer should it take? I have twice as many points in the x direction, and I have twice as many points in the y direction, and the time integrator probably needs to take twice as many times, because the speed of sound in that system is the same. So the natural time step size is also smaller by a factor of 2. So it should take 8 times as long as before. So changing the resolution by a factor of 2 in a 2D problem is kind of an expensive thing to do. It's even worse in 3D. And now you see that the resolutions kind of look on top of each other, but there still is a measurable difference of 5% or so. And then if we chose an even higher resolution, it would probably lie on top of each other. But I could have also an even lower resolution, then the error would be even larger. Okay, that was a bit confusing maybe, what I did in the end. Do you have questions regarding that? Okay, so there's a thing called a convergence rate. And to calculate a convergence rate, I'm not going to write the equations on a blackboard. They're available in textbooks or tutorials or something, where you calculate the difference between the solution that you get for a particular resolution and the true solution. And this error should have a particular behavior with respect to h. So here we're using second order finite differences. So I would expect that the difference, so let's call it fh, is the solution that we have for a particular resolution h, and let's call f star the true solution, and let's calculate it at a particular point of t and x minus f star t and x, and let's say calculate the norm all over x, because I just want to point, don't want to look at just a single point, so you calculate the norm, square it, and we integrate over the whole domain. And take a square root. Oh no, it's complicated. I wish there was an easier way to calculate a square root. But this is what we do. And this should be a term of the order of h squared. H squared, because we use this stencil, which is second order accurate. If you find your error is too large, then you can, say, go to a fourth order accurate solution, moving this to h to the fourth. we're using a fourth order stencil. It's a more complicated stencil. There are more trouble at the boundaries, but things would converge faster because it would converge to fourth order. And yes, what we should be knowing now, but I ran out of time, is evaluate a term like this and for various resolutions, not just for one resolutions, but you can calculate, say, for three different resolutions, and then you can put the error into a plot, and then you actually see how the error behaves. So the plot would look something like this. This would be the resolution H, and this would be the error, the log of the error, and the resolution H, yeah, would also be a log plot in H, and then you have, say, a resolution of 1 over 20, 1 over 40, 1 over 80, and so on. And you would see how the error and how the error usually behaves. It kind of stays constant, and then it drops down, and then it becomes constant again at about 10 to minus 15 or so. This is about 10 to the 0. And the slope here, and this log-log plot, would be minus 2, because it converges like h squared. So you would plot the solution for multiple h, and then you would kind of see that the error really decreases, like one, or like, well, h squared, h to the minus 2, it's h to the minus 2, is it not? Plus terms of the order h. Oh no, it's negative here because, if h becomes smaller, it becomes better. Okay, whatever. You know what I mean. If you make h smaller, things improve. And why would that flatten out at 10 to the minus 15? That is the floating point error. You're doing calculations with floating point numbers. So no matter what you do, you can never get more accurate than about 10 to the minus 15. If you use a finite differencing method, the error is much larger. I mean, look at the error there. It's probably 10 to the minus 1 or 10 to the minus 2. You're really far away from 10 to the minus 15. But spectral methods can be really accurate. So if you repeat this with a homework question where you use a spectral method, then it should be fairly straightforward to come to a regime where everything is limited by floating point error. And that could also be 10 to the minus 12 or similar. Okay, that concludes my lecture today. I'll be there this afternoon in the tutorial in case you have questions on the course. And also, you'll get started with your homework question then. Thank you.